Welcome to Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. I'm John Schumann. This is the first in a new four-episode series, so thanks for joining us. First up, joining us as he does most weeks is Gary Schweitzer, publisher of healthnewsreview.org. Gary, you were at a conference at the National Institutes of Health last week, the third annual Preventing Overdiagnosis Conference. What was that all about?
Well, it's a group of like-minded folks who really look at some issues that are overlapping. So overdiagnosis, overuse, overtreatment of some technologies and approaches in healthcare for which not all the evidence might be in, or for which there's evidence that overuse, overdiagnosis, and overtreatment may carry more harm than good.
So let's start with overtreatment. So how can you be overtreated? If you have a problem, you get treatment for it. What do you mean overtreatment?
Well, what can often happen is people for whom there isn't evidence of benefit, and there might be more benefit of harm from treatment, end up getting treatment anyway. And the reason this conference looked at overdiagnosis is that it is the diagnosis up front that labels more of us as patients who then become treated. So one way to look at this, and why don't you and I try to have a little bit of fun here? We're sometimes too serious. There's a whole alphabet soup of acronyms, of initials. That a lot of drug companies create these to actually create new conditions, and then lo and behold, they have a drug for it. So let me see how up on things you are, John. So
I like to think I keep up pretty well.
Okay, well, tell me, have you heard of the acronym, which is a diagnosis, called ABL?
Well, that sounds like all but lissertation.
Try accidental bowel leakage.
Ooh, no.
And how did I hear about that? Well, there's an ad for a product called Butterfly Body Liners that fit discreetly between the buttocks. And I saw this on national TV. So but what I'm going to be touching on here are things that I've seen in advertising and in journalism through the years on our site. How about BBS?
Bloated bowel syndrome?
You're close, but it's bashful bladder syndrome, also technically called periuresis, or bashful kidneys, or pee fright, or pee shyness. And yes, wouldn't you know, oh, there's another name for it, creeping pee-pee. And wouldn't you know, antidepressants are sometimes prescribed for this condition. So how about GAD, G-A-D? I bet you know that one.
Generalized anxiety disorder.
Exactly. Bingo. You win a prize, and the prize for many people who get that diagnosis is, again, often antidepressants. So what did you get? You got one out of three. So
that would not get me Carl Castle's voice on the Home
well,
Answer.
Well, you can have mine. It's cheaper and
it's pretty good.
Yeah, there you go. So I gave a talk at this conference, and it was on the influence of the media in either preventing or promoting overdiagnosis. And so I had one of my staff people look back on our site where we've reviewed media messages for 9.5 years and just look for examples of overdiagnosis themes. And she stopped at 180 examples, and she had really just barely scratched the surface. But what I had her do then was to look in different categories. So did we often see women's health issues that promoted overdiagnosis, or men's health, or other categories? And indeed, we did. So, well, can you think of an example in women's health where overdiagnosis is an issue?
Well, thinking along the lines of the acronyms you gave me, I think of something like, never used to be a disease, but, you know, dreaded, like premenstrual dysphoric disorder, something like that.
Yep. PMDD, yeah, that was on the list. You know, menopause is over-medicalized, over-diagnosed as a leading women's health issue. So one example here, CNN reported sometime back that a new study shows beyond a doubt that menopause, and not the natural aging process, is responsible for a sharp increase in cholesterol levels. Wait a minute, think about that line. When did menopause stop being part of the natural aging process? And that's how we lure people in. We take healthy people, we label them as now having a condition, and then we treat them. Of course, one of the biggest recent ones is female sexual dysfunction, with the approval of a new drug that I think at its best was reported to increase satisfying sexual events by 0.7 per month. I don't know. You try to explain to me what less than one new satisfying sexual event per month really means.
Is this, and this is for a drug that has to be taken every day?
Yes.
Doesn't seem worth it.
So other women's health issues, women and aging leads to messages of overdiagnosis often. So osteoporosis can be a serious bone thinning problem, especially in women, also in men. But now we have these pre-disease categories, and in osteoporosis, it's called osteopenia. And I saw an article by a blogger in the Washington Post who was really giddy about an episode of Glee, saying that the journalist was really impressed by Gwyneth Paltrow singing and dancing on Glee, and the journalist said that Paltrow's dance performances were particularly impressive to me in light of her recent diagnosis of osteopenia. And that is just taking this a little bit too far, that this...
She's become the poster child for osteopenia? I was not aware of that.
So a healthy, beautiful, young actress, we're going to be wowed by her dance performance because she has osteopenia. That's just taking things to a new level, and often in promotion of new products. But then we have a lot of men's health categories as well, so...
Yeah, well, I'm going to guess here there's a lot to do with probably testosterone in aging males, but you try me out.
Yep, low T, low testosterone is probably the poster child for overdiagnosis in men, where that can be an issue in some men, but the drug ads would lead you to believe that it's something that all of us men should be concerned about. And here's something you've probably seen. Now, this is a news coverage issue where journalists will tell men what to do in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. So tips for men no matter what decade you're in. So the Washington Post had an article like that. And among the questionable advice that they gave in their story was telling men in their 30s that they ought to all have complete physicals. Mm. I mean, that was a belief of decades ago, but there are not evidence-based recommendations to support all men in their 30s having a complete physical. Telling every man in their 40s to get a complete physical every 2 years. Again, there is not an evidence-based recommendation to back that up. CNN had a similar tips for men in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. They told every man in their 30s that they should have a baseline electrocardiogram. That certainly is not supported by the preventive healthcare recommendations of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. They, too, said every man should visit their doctor annually. That is not supported by the evidence. And they said that men in their 50s should be aware that they need prostate cancer screening. Emphasis on need prostate cancer screening. The American Urological Association, the urologists who used to promote prostate cancer screening, even promote more of a shared decision-making approach and a more careful consideration of prostate cancer screening than that CNN story did. So it was kind of mind-boggling to me to step back as I prepared for this talk at NIH and see the dozens and dozens and dozens of examples. Menopause in women. Time magazine had a cover story called Manopause, getting at the low T issue that you raised. And one person who heard my talk, a physician, said, I don't know how you can stand to look at this stuff every day.
Well, you know, it brings to mind the question of the fact that these news sources, you know, pretty reputable ones, CNN, Time Magazine, The Washington Post, they seem to take a default posture of, you know, more medical care is good, and where we're not going to do the investigative work necessary to show what the evidence is, we're going to default to this position of, you basically ask your doctor, because it's never really wrong to ask your doctor, but you know, it does seem stuck in kind of a 1960s-ish, 1970s-ish approach. And we should tell our listeners that you mentioned some things that may come across to listeners as pretty shocking stuff. You know, men in their 30s or 40s not having a physical, not being advised by. It's because when we look at the sum total of evidence of tens or hundreds of thousands of patients, these are not thought to be cost-effective strategies to go fishing on fishing expeditions looking for diseases. It's much more reasonable approach by evidence and certainly from a cost-effective standpoint to do investigations once people have symptoms. So there's no evidence for baseline electrocardiograms, as you mentioned, or and of course, you know, prostate cancer screening is something that's pretty controversial. And as you point out, even the urologists say a shared decision-making approach where, you know, discussing the values that a patient has, you know, what his values might be with regard to, obviously family history is going to play a key role, but education, very important. The non-urologists, the sort of general physicians approach has actually been to counsel and recommend against prostate cancer screening. So that's something that sounds unorthodox and sounds very confusing for patients to hear.
Well, and you could ask any primary care physician about whether it is indeed harmless to say, ask your doctor about this. I don't think it is harmless. I think that a good primary care physician has so much to cover in the limited amount of face time that he or she has with a patient that to spend time, often unnecessarily, refuting claims about newly named conditions, and does this apply to me, the patient asks, is, take this the way it's meant, a waste of time when you ought to be using that time checking on compliance from past prescriptions, checking on updated history, checking on, you know, how's it going in your life, and actually having a time to just get a good update, and not spending that limited amount of time while the clock is ticking refuting things that could have been handled better or completely ignored in media messages.
Gary Schweitzer is the founder and publisher of the website healthnewsreview.org. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye. You're listening to Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. I'm John Schumann. Coming up next, we have a reprise of an interview we did about a year ago with journalist Elizabeth Rosenthal of the New York Times. She wrote an award-winning series called Pain Till It Hurts, which finished its run in December. She's now turning it into a book. Rosenthal began her career as an emergency medicine physician before switching entirely over to journalism in 1994. Her series explores the exorbitant costs of healthcare in the United States. Everything from the price of pharmaceuticals to what we pay for hospitalizations and things like prosthetic hips and knees. Elizabeth Rosenthal, welcome to Medical Matters.
Thanks for having me.
I just wanted to start really basic, and for those that haven't seen your series, how much does healthcare cost us in the United States, and what does that figure actually mean?
Well, the figure that's always given is 2.7, when I started the series, now $2.8 trillion a year. And when you look at that, of course, it's far more than any other country spends per capita. And what does it mean? It means that at some level, we're not getting what we pay for. We pay a lot more, and our results tend to be about the same, if not a little worse, than other developed countries. So that's why I started the series. I wanted to find out, as a physician and as a patient, why we were paying so much, not for the $500,000 cancer drugs, although I think that's a big issue too, but even for the common procedures, the common medical encounters that we've all had, and we open the explanation of benefits or the bills in the privacy of our living room or our kitchen and think, wow, you know, $10,000 for that, that seems crazy. So my goal in this series is to look at ordinary encounters and try and trace the money to see why it adds up to so much.
What are the main drivers of that exorbitant cost? In other words, is it, you know, the amount of money doctors make? Is it hospital care? Is it the expensive medications we pay for in the United States? I mean, how does it rank in terms of what's the most costly items?
Well, I think my answer is always all of the above, and patient expectations too. And that's been part of the problem in solving it, of course, is that, you know, the hospitals say it's not us, it's the insurers. The insurers say, don't look at us, it's these doctors. And patients are kind of in the middle of this maelstrom at the moment. And I think the thing is, yes, we pay more for hospital stays. Our per-day hospital costs are 2, 3, 4 times what they are in other countries. We pay more for the exact same medicines. We pay more for our doctor's visits. we get more doctor's visits, we get more scans, and we pay more for scans. It's kind of everything.
It's just like a fantasy world or something, right, where it costs. I mean, if you went to Canada, for example, and you got the exact same service or services and scans and medicines, first of all, you probably wouldn't pay anything out of your pocket, or if you did, it'd be very little, and the overall charge, the bill, would be vastly less.
Right, that's true. And one thing that we, you know, the services are generally the same in other countries as in the U.S. One thing we have far more of than most other countries is, of course, administrative costs. There was a new study out in Health Affairs showing that we spent something like 28% of our healthcare costs go for insurance administration at hospitals. And when you think of all the money, not the time, that ordinary patients like you and me and our well, you, in your case, patients, I don't have them anymore, spend just troubleshooting insurance claims that's not even valued when we say we spend $2.8 trillion. I mean, there are people I've spoken to in the course of this series who are, you know, high-powered lawyers who take off 5 days of work to troubleshoot pretty simple hospital bills. So, you know, the administrative costs are certainly pretty unique to our system. And then everything else is just we do things in a more expensive way and we do more of it.
So I wanted to follow up on that because I've heard that thrown around, too, that for one thing that we spend vastly more on administrative costs than any of the other comparable developed, say, Western nations that seem to certainly spend a lot less and get similar or even better outcomes than we do. So one question is, you know, what is administrative costs? I mean, why is it so much in the U.S. and what does it actually mean?
Well, it means, you know, it's obvious at some level that a national health system has lower administrative costs because you have one payer, you know, you have set prices. There's not a lot of the negotiation that's so typical of every step of our system that goes on in those countries. But what you find is that even countries that have fee-for-service systems tend to spend far less on administrative costs. And in our country, it's really because every bill, and we've all seen this, is negotiated endlessly because there's not one bill. You go into an emergency room and there are four bills, you know, from the ER doctor, from the ER, from the radiologist, from the lab, and each of those requires a separate negotiation. And of course, we all have different insurance plans, and even if you and I both have United Health Plan, the terms of those plans is completely different. So the amount of time and effort and personnel that are spent in troubleshooting every step of that negotiation is really pretty mind-boggling. I think one of the most disturbing statistics in some ways that I encountered in the course of this series was that between a patient who needs an artificial hip and the producer of that hip, there are 13 steps of purchasing involved and negotiation involved. And that's just such an incredibly inefficient way to do things. You know, there's the hospital who buys the hip from the manufacturer, but he or she doesn't buy that hip directly. It goes through a joint broker, which is kind of this extra step that doesn't exist anywhere else. Then meanwhile, your surgeon picks the kind of joint you get. But you don't know, is your insurance paying full price for that joint? What's the hospital markup? There are just so many intermediary steps. Whereas in one of the articles, I compared a joint replacement here to one in Belgium, where the Belgian government just says, okay, this is what we're paying for this joint, and the hospitals can order it. So it just does away with 10 steps of that negotiation. I mean, our system is so inherently inefficient. And P.S., that's kind of part of the problem because it's a huge employer. Inefficiency is pretty good for jobs, unfortunately.
So I was staggered by that 13 middlemen between. So it's not just like a hospital says, okay, Stryker, or that's just the name of one of the companies, we're going to buy this kind of hip and stock them on the shelf. No, in fact, as you point out, the surgeon, him or herself, will use the broker. And I mean, who knew that there were such things as joint brokers?
Right.
So there are these middlemen that, you know, and at each step, there's a markup.
Right, and the hospital may well employ, and this is another position I didn't even know existed, the hospital may well employ a service to negotiate better prices of the artificial joints, and that person will speak to a joint broker, and it's just these endless middlemen involved in this process. It could be so much more streamlined, and of course, when you say, well, why does an artificial joint cost $20,000, often more than that on a hospital bill, in the U.S., whereas it would be billed at, you know, a few thousand in another country. Part of that answer is the endless complexity of our purchasing system, and part of it is, of course, also that we do not have any form of price controls, which most other countries do have.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. We're speaking today with Elizabeth Rosenthal, a reporter for the New York Times, who has done a year-long series on the costs of healthcare in the United States. And we're talking currently about one piece in the series where you compared how much a hip replacement would cost in the United States versus, in the case you wrote about, Belgium. Elizabeth, why are there no generic hips or knees? You know, for example, if I take a cholesterol drug, there used to be Lipitor, and now I can get generic atorvastatin, which is a much lower price. That's right. Not true for knees or hips.
Well, it's a little hard to see why it doesn't exist, why no one would jump into the market. But what I've been told is because, you know, these are basically devices that are made of metal and plastic, ceramic. They are complicated, but not that complicated. But the market is really dominated by a few very, very large producers. And, of course, the surgeons have extreme brand loyalty to one of those producers. There are five producers globally of brand name hip and knee replacements. Three of them are in a little town called Warsaw, Indiana, where everyone knows each other. So there's not a lot of incentive in Warsaw, Indiana to try and undercut your neighbor's price. Everyone is kind of working together on this, though not by definition colluding. But those five manufacturers have incredible power in the market, partly because these are surgeon discretion items. So what happens is all of these five companies, they really want to get into the ORs of orthopedic training programs, because there they develop what ends up being a fairly lifelong relationship with an emerging orthopedic surgeon. A surgeon gets to know how to put in, I'm really good at putting in Stryker devices. I know how they work. I've worked with their toolkit before. Most orthopedists have an ongoing relationship with a rep from one of those companies, and a rep from one of those companies is actually in the operating room, a technician, to help put in the joint. So say I want to make a generic joint. It's really, really hard to break into that market because you have to cut through all the old loyalties that exist and all the old comfort that we know as physicians exists when you're using a piece of equipment or a technology that you've become familiar with over the years. So it takes a lot to break down that. You need something really disruptive.
That's a great example of, I think, how the relationships are so important. And as you point out, how imperative it is for whether it's the manufacturers or the pharmaceutical firms to have those relationships with people early on in their training to kind of cement those relationships. So going on with the orthopedic issue, one thing you taught me about in the piece was about a knee specially designed for women, and I was intrigued by that idea. It seems like a pretty good idea, actually.
Yeah, it is, although partly what's happened, we're one of two countries in the world that allow direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceutical products, and that goes for devices as well. So we have a lot of device advertising, and it's not clear. I mean, a female knee replacement, obviously, there are many companies that make devices of many different sizes that are better or worse for different patients. But a company basically can rebrand that device with an advertising campaign that says, as this company did in the, you know, AARP magazine, oh, you're thinking of a knee replacement? Get the female knee. Now, that would be fine if, you know, in terms of the economics of it, that would be fine if it was kind of the same price as the other knee, because really we know the difference in that knee is just the sizing. But in fact, once you brand something the female knee and give it a kind of fun name, the charges get much, much higher. It's not just a knee that's tailored to, you know, the biodynamics of women, but it's a knee that becomes a kind of luxury brand item, and that's where the problem comes in.
So you're really saying that the knee for women is all about marketing, not so much about the biomechanics.
Well, it is different, but other companies make knees that biomechanically are better for women than other joint replacements, but one company had the idea of we can market it and brand it in this way. And I don't want to demean artificial knees, which I probably sound like I'm doing, but it's not so different when, you know, when food companies decide to repackage, you know, I always think of Lunchables. You put some bologna and crackers in a box and say, this is something new and different. Well, yes and no.
Packaging, yes. All right, I want to finish this knee and hip thing because That piece in the series also focused on a particularly interesting issue that I think is only growing in importance, and that is the idea of medical tourism.
Yep.
So you write beautifully about the subject of the story, whose name escapes me at the moment, but who went, he decided after pricing things out, he found out that going to Europe, going to Belgium, and having this a la carte hip replacement that included, you know, not only the operation, but the hospitalization and the rehabilitation, he saved a significant amount of money. Now, he was going to Western Europe, but you also touch on the fact that it seems like more and more people are considering, and this patient that you wrote about ruled it out, but that some people will go to India or Thailand, you know, more in the developing world, some folks to Mexico versus Europe. What were some of the considerations for folks in this medical tourism trade? I mean, it's clearly about price, but I think these other nations certainly want to say it's about service and quality as well.
Yes, I think, you know, Michael Chopin, who was the character in that story, he was the best medical consumer ever. I don't know if you remember, but he tried to price out his hip replacement in the U.S., and I want to make sure everyone understands he had insurance. You know, the people in the series are not people who didn't have insurance. He had insurance, but because hip arthritis was considered a pre-existing condition, it wouldn't cover a hip replacement. So he had to go out and price it, and he went so far as to find someone who knew someone at Stryker who could get him a wholesale device. And he decided, after doing a lot of research, that he just couldn't afford it in the U.S. and that he would go overseas. And as you mentioned, he didn't want to go to the developing world. So he did a lot of research about countries and hospitals that have good outcomes and ended up at this hospital in Belgium. So, you know, yes, he could have gotten it even cheaper if he'd been willing to go to the developing world. And there are, of course, issues with quality that people will bring up, and people are not going happily, generally, to the developing world or overseas. They would prefer to stay at home, but the price difference is just so astronomical and so compelling that the choice isn't getting it done at home or getting it done overseas. It's getting it done or not getting it done at all. You know, and there are increasing number of companies that will cater to this need. As someone pointed out to me, you can do this within the United States as well. I mean, there are certain parts of our country that are much cheaper for medical care. Someone joked with me that the best way for the New York Times to save on its health insurance costs would be to put patients in limos and drive them up to Buffalo, where health care costs are a fraction of what they are in New York City. So, you know, this will happen both domestically and internationally. But at some level, too, it's a sad commentary on how we are pricing medical care and how we are pricing even well-insured people out of our system.
So is anyone really doing that yet, taking the limo to Buffalo for their elective surgery?
Not that I've heard of, but there are services in the U.S., and again, I look at them with a mix of admiration and thinking, wow, that's kind of sad. There's one service called Medibid that if you have an elective procedure you need done, you can go on their website and you can look at where you can get it done cheaply. Doctors from different parts of the country will say, you know, I'm willing to do this colonoscopy for $X thousand or $X hundred for a colonoscopy or this hip replacement for $X thousand. So, yeah, you can get some good deals that way. And, you know, I continue to say that I think most hospitals in the U.S. give really good medical care, so it's not that important where you get your colonoscopy. And certainly if one costs $500 and the other one costs $10,000, I don't think there's a 20-fold difference. So we are seeing more of that market-based approach emerge, but it's pretty hard, you know, especially if you've got an older person to say, okay, you know, you need a hip replacement, fly 1,000 miles away to get it because it's going to cost you 1/5 the price there. I don't know that that's really where we want to go.
You're writing about insured patients, so that it's different than say, the uninsured patient who's paying typically the rack rate or getting charged the rack rate. So even for routine care that's typically recommended, you wrote in, I think, one of the very first articles in the series about the price of a colonoscopy. So one question I had is, you know, and I think you alluded to this, why do we default to that test? Because in general, it's a more expensive test. But I think what you found is that the price of it is vastly different across the country.
Yeah, the pricing varies tremendously. I think the highest price paid for a colonoscopy in Baltimore was $1,900, which is high anyway, but the highest price in New York was about $9,000, which is what my insurer paid for mine, actually. I think the cost is highly variable, and we do tend to default to the more expensive options. And what you see in the U.S. is that and I heard many complaints from doctors about this. You see your patients getting more colonoscopies than are even recommended, and age groups where you really wouldn't, you know, I heard from a lot of geriatricians who were very upset that their 90-year-old nursing home patients were being told they needed a screening colonoscopy. I mean, that doesn't make sense. More of the elderly, weak people will end up injuring themselves with that, you know, the night before prep, running to the bathroom, then they will be helped by having a screening colonoscopy. But the financial incentives are all to say, do more, do more, do more. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't tons of honest physicians out there who don't do this. But what it does mean is that those physicians who want to be entrepreneurial or who have, you know, a business consultant who comes in and says, how can I make my practice earn more money? There are answers that are really good from an economic point of view, but not really good when you're talking about what's best for healthcare.
One of the issues that came up in the discussion on colonoscopies was, well, two particular things. One was the concept of a facility fee, and I wonder if you could help us understand what the heck that is.
Well, I always try to compare what I'm looking at in the series with how it's done in other countries, and when I called a couple of people who did colonoscopy and the big colonoscopy experts in Germany and Austria and said, well, what's the facility fee? There was this silence at the other end of the phone, like, what do you mean facility fee? You can't do a colonoscopy without a facility fee. So this has evolved as over the last maybe 10 years in the United States as a big moneymaker. Medicare, and all of these things grow out of good intentions. The concept of a facility fee is to pay the physician or the provider for the cost of maintaining the facility. And obviously a hospital has a lot of maintenance costs that aren't really taken in when you just get a straight physician fee or a straight payment. So the facility fees are different, whether it's in a doctor's office where you don't get a facility fee, whether it's in a surgery center where you get a smaller facility fee, or in a hospital where you get a larger facility fee. And again, a well-meaning effort to compensate different providers for their different expenses. But again, if you want to be entrepreneurial about it, what do? You say, well, I'm not going to do colonoscopies in my office anymore because I can't charge a facility fee. So you and your partners open up, you know, an outpatient surgery center where you get the facility fee for colonoscopies. Or you, if you want to be really entrepreneurial about it, and we see this as hospital and physician groups are consolidating, they say, oh, you know, come do your colonoscopies in our hospital. And then you get the hospital facility fee. So if you want to maximize your income, you move everything to the more expensive place to do it, which is exactly the opposite of what we want. And I know Medicare and a number of healthcare researchers now are talking about reverting to a facility-neutral payments, which I think, you know, we're likely to see in the coming years. And to me, the greatest irony of this is when I started practicing medicine, all the outpatient surgery centers were in their infancy, and the whole point of outpatient surgery centers was that they were lower cost than hospitals, so you could do all these wonderful things like arthroscopies that previously would have had to have been done in a hospital with an admission on an outpatient basis, which is great, and it's lower cost. But now what we've seen is kind of that good intention being perverted to move things that could have been done in office into a surgery center where it becomes more expensive.
As long as we're talking about outpatient surgical centers, I have to ask you about Joan Rivers, who I guess unfortunately met her demise in one in Manhattan.
Yep.
Do you see any change that will come in terms of regulating outpatient surgical centers in the wake of what happened to Joan Rivers?
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty intensely regulated, which is partly why the costs go up a lot, because to operate an outpatient surgery center, you know, you have to get there's a lot of licensing involved in most states. And I don't know enough about what was the anesthesia provided there. You know, I do worry a little bit that when people hear about bad outcomes and celebrities like that, the lesson will be, you know, wow, we have to have an anesthesiologist in the room every time a sedation is given, which, of course, again, will be a big driver of health care costs in our country. the trend has been to use anesthesiologists or nurse anesthetists for things like colonoscopies to give propofol. In many other countries, the physicians give the propofol, the gastroenterologists give the propofol themselves. So, you know, it's really hard to say from one high-profile case what went wrong there. The first lesson I draw, not knowing the details, is you always want to avoid surgery you don't really need.
Yeah. Do we know what she was having done?
No. I think they said something on her vocal cords. But, you know, I think all of us who've trained as physicians have respect for surgery. And, you know, it's great when you need it. And if you don't need it, we all have seen cases where things didn't go as planned, even when everyone did the best they could. So I think we have to wait for more information on that case to know what lessons to draw from it.
This is Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. We're talking today with Elizabeth Rosenthal, a reporter for the New York Times, who's done a wonderful series titled Pain Till It Hurts, a multi-part series on the cost of healthcare in the United States. And one of the multimedia features that you have in the series, which was in a story on medication and how much more expensive medications are in the United States than elsewhere, was a tool through which you could click on it and see what $250 of certain medications would get you in the U.S. versus many different other countries in the world. How did you come up with that idea? Or who was there a graphic?
It's my favorite graphic in the history of the New York Times. I have to say it's a wonderful multimedia graphic. And my concern is that no one would read the story. They would all be sitting there playing with that graphic. Basically, we had some data about comparative manufacturers recommended prices in different countries for different drugs, and we wanted to figure out a kind of compelling way to use that, because everyone has heard, oh, drugs are more expensive in the U.S. than they are elsewhere. I think we often like to say, oh, well, that's because they have socialized health care, people don't pay for it, and this chart is partly wonderful just because those prices are manufacturers' recommended prices, so it's not even accounting for what a person actually pays out of pocket. And basically, since the story focused on asthma treatment, we decided to look at first a couple of the asthma meds, particularly Advair, which is hugely expensive in the United States. And one patient told me he financed his, this is really a first world problem, he financed his Paris vacations each summer by buying 7 Advairs for what it would cost him to buy 1 in the United States. So that became the seed of this graphic. And you can see that $250 goes a lot farther, sometimes 8,000 times farther in buying different drugs overseas than in the United States. And of course, you know, a number of patients have started to, out of necessity and out of the desire to save money, exploit that difference by ordering drugs from overseas. And the FDA doesn't like that. It is in a legal gray area. And, you know, we will see over the coming months some tests of that.
One of the other things that is so great about the series in the multimedia fashion is you have thought-provoking questions that accompany each story. And so you break it down by patients themselves who often will write comments on the stories, uninsured people who write their own, you know, share their own stories essentially of how they deal with this cost conundrum, and then, you know, medical professionals too. And I certainly, as a doctor, I loved looking through the way doctors, in a sense, game the system to what I would call the moral good, which is they're trying to either help themselves or their families because they have a deeper understanding of the system, or certainly trying to help their patients get around some of these exorbitant costs for medications. The answers were pretty savvy.
Yeah, you know, we added that category of provider after the first few stories when we realized we were getting a lot of really interesting comments from physicians and other kinds of providers about the dilemmas they were seeing in their practice and ways they'd kind of come up with to help their patients. Also, a lot of frustration. One thing that's been interesting about the series is every patient in the series is someone who commented on an earlier article. They've all come in through social media, and many of the physicians as well. So, you know, I guess what's striking to me, and when I talk to physician groups, I emphasize this, you know, there are a lot of physicians who are very unhappy with how this system is working for them and for their patients, because, of course, when your patient goes for a MRI and discovers it's, you know, $3,000 and, oh, guess what, the radiologist is out of network, your patient comes back to you in frustration and says, hey, doc, you know, why did you send me there? So I think there's a certain alliance between particularly the primary care doctors and the patients that we will see growing and perhaps producing some change.
So you if I understood you correctly, you're saying that essentially subsequent stories in the series came via social media or via commenters
yep.
to some of the original stories. Tell us what you did in order to kind of potentiate interest in
the
series.
Yeah, sure, and I hope everyone joins in. We decided after many months of the series, there was an incredible, we've had 10,000 plus comments to the first installment and many tens of thousands more in the course of the series. And it was really clear that people wanted to talk about this, but there isn't a really good forum to talk about it. So we decided to start a Facebook group where people can join and share experiences, share solutions, share interesting articles. And it's really, really been fascinating to me because I learn things from it. I post things there most days, and I also learn from our contributors who range from physicians to patients to advocates to insurance execs. You know, the thing that's striking to me is no one, I think, really likes the system the way it is, and everyone has different ideas about how to change it. So it's been really fascinating. I urge everyone who's interested in this topic, and particularly those who are obsessed with it, like me, to join our Pain Till It Hurts Facebook group. I also urge people, this is one thing we haven't talked about, to take the, we developed this online quiz called Is This a Hospital or a Hotel? Where you can take a test where you see pictures of, I think, 12 different hospitals or hotels, and you have to guess. And partly I wanted to make the point about hospital overbuilding in this country and what patients expect, because patients often see themselves as victims of this system, which they are to a large degree, but also they help perpetuate it because, patients in the U.S. now want to see private rooms. They want to see, Starbucks in the lobby. And our hospitals have come to look more like our five-star hotels, and I can tell you that does affect our bills.
Amenities. We all want amenities.
Yes.
I wanted to tackle one more area, which you touch on in one of the pieces, about nonprofit hospitals. The vast majority of hospitals in the U.S. are still nonprofit, and an issue that's come up, I would say, politically is that a lot of people feel like, given the sort of enormous costs in healthcare and the enormous revenues, I guess you could say, that a lot of these nonprofit hospitals make, that there are some lawmakers and politicians who want essentially to strip hospitals of their tax-exempt status, arguing essentially they don't provide enough community benefit. What did your research and reporting tell you about this aspect?
Well, it's a very, very complicated area. It will, again, as we struggle to deal with this issue of healthcare costs, we really need to define better what we expect out of our not-for-profits. You know, when you think of the number of cities in the U.S. where the biggest employer is the medical center, when you think of how many medical centers are doing things now that don't really benefit their immediate community, they're opening hospitals in China or opening clinics in Dubai, they have all sorts of side ventures, so should they be paying payroll taxes? Should they be paying property taxes? I think a lot of cities that are, still reeling from the financial crisis are looking at these fancy new buildings and saying, hey, wait a second. It seems like you have the money to pay taxes, and it's not clear. Maybe some of what you do is good for our community, but it doesn't seem you're very mission-driven anymore. So I think we're going to be seeing some reevaluating of that, but also, of course, hospitals are powerful political players in most cities. I think I read something that they are the major employer now in something like a third of U.S. cities. So, they have a lot of clout to keep their tax-exempt status. And I don't know that there's a right or a wrong answer. And some hospitals clearly are much more committed to serving their community than others. But I know there are a lot of people out there who think we need to rethink this whole idea of tax exemption for hospitals. And often when I say that, people will say, and yes, and some of the universities too. So I think, it's a broader question than just hospitals. But, it is true. Some of these nonprofit hospitals are among the most profitable endeavors and certainly the most profitable nonprofits in the country. If you look at the top paid nonprofit executive in every state, it's almost always a hospital executive. So, I was in Arkansas doing another story. The head of the Clinton Foundation in Arkansas makes a small fraction of what hospital presidents make in that state. So I think we really have to make sure we get what we're paying for and make sure they deserve the tax breaks they get, because being a not-for-profit hospital means only that there are no shareholders. It doesn't mean that they can't have a positive operating budget, which many, many of them do, and all it means is that they plow that back into the organization. Now, they may plow it back into good things or, you know, healthcare things like building a clinic in an underserved neighborhood, but they can also plow it back into art for the lobby and, you know, high executive compensation, which I think most of us would say that's not what we want our nonprofits to be focusing on.
Elizabeth Rosenthal is our guest. She's a reporter for the New York Times. The name of the series is Paying Till It Hurts. And if you're interested in further information, you can look at the Facebook group Paying Till It Hurts. You can just check that out there. Elizabeth Rosenthal, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're with Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. Sherry Yerkowitz was a fourth-year medical student when she wrote this essay called Postoperative Check.
It's okay that you don't remember me. My name is Shara, and I'm part of the surgical team. I'm checking to see how you're doing after your surgery. Do you know where you are right now? Actually, you're in the hospital. You had surgery a few hours ago for a broken hip. You used to be able to walk before you broke it, so it was important to fix it as soon as it was safe to. We're not sure how you broke it either. You said you couldn't remember falling or even having much pain. Your daughter noticed swelling in your leg a few days ago and brought you here. She went home for a bit, but she's been here with you the past few days. We waited a few days before the surgery to make sure you were medically ready. You had some fluid in your lungs when you first arrived, so we gave you medications to help get rid of it. It probably wasn't related to what you ate or drank. You were eating a lot, though. You're the only person I've ever seen with a broken hip with that good of an appetite. Do you remember the last thing you ate before your surgery? It was a big chocolate chip cookie. I was there during the surgery. I'm still a student, so I didn't do much. But you can learn a lot from watching. Thank you for letting me watch. I was there when they wheeled you into the room. Your surgical cap was too big for you, and it kept falling off. We asked you your name, and you said it. All three names. We didn't even ask you for the middle one, because we didn't know you had one. We then put you to sleep. You took deep breaths through an oxygen mask before we turned off your consciousness and paralyzed your body. I held your hand as you closed your eyes. The nurse whispered to you that everything would be okay. We fixed the bone. It took a few hours, because your bone is fragile. There was bleeding, but that's normal. Bone bleeds a lot. We gave you blood and fluids to replace what you lost. Did you know that many surgeons play music during operations? It was going so smoothly that we were humming along to Who Says You Can't Go Home. It was during the bridge of the song that your blood pressure suddenly dropped. The anesthesiologist called it out. I looked at the monitor and saw numbers flashing in red. There was a lot of red, actually. Blood in the wound, blood in the suction container, blood in transfusion bags, bloody footprints on the floor. No more than with any other patient. But I think somewhere along the way, I learned to take the sight of liters of blood for granted. I was scared. I stopped watching them stitch and stared at the monitor, which suddenly seemed like my closest connection to you. They called out the medications they were giving you to raise your blood pressure. After a few minutes, it worked. Your blood pressure slowly climbed to green numbers. I was still shaking as I silently willed the numbers to stop bouncing around. But the numbers stubbornly drifted down, even though they were keeping up with the fluids, even though you were on medications that force your blood vessels to clamp down and your heart to beat harder. The red returned and was unrelenting. Your blood pressure was too low, your heart rate too high, the tracing of your heart rhythm irregular and non-shockable. We can be done in 10 minutes, the surgeon said. I've never seen surgeons work so fast. They're usually so particular about their stitches, getting the perfect angle and length for each one. I've also never seen so many anesthesiologists at the head of an operating table. I've never seen an ICU bed booked so quickly. I've never seen someone lose their carotid pulse. Apparently, it's rare to die on the operating table. They almost always get you to the ICU first. Twice in 8 years, said the anesthesiologist. Once in 15 years, said the surgeon. Once in 80 years for you. I couldn't bring myself to touch your hand again. I watched, though. I watched as the room slowly cleared, and people tried to figure out what to write and who to call. I watched as they kept your eyes shut and handled your body just as gently as they had a few hours ago. I listened to the final zip of the body bag. I don't know who had the time to switch off the radio, but I'm glad they did. I listened as the nurse asked God to rest your soul. I watched you leave in a different kind of bed, to a different place. I'm not sure where. You can learn a lot from watching. Thank you for letting me watch. We fixed your hip, sir.
Postoperative Check is an essay that Sherry Yerkowitz wrote when she was a fourth-year medical student at Harvard Medical School. She wrote it on her blog, This May Hurt a Bit. It was reposted on an NPR science blog and quickly went viral. Yerkowitz spent the past year as an editorial intern for MedPage Today. She's currently an intern in medicine at a hospital in New Jersey. Next week on the program, we take an in-depth look at the heroin problem in small-town America. We speak with Sam Quinones, author of the book Dreamland. Medical Matters is produced at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the campus of the University of Tulsa. Scott Gregory produced and edited today's show. Music for the show is created by Scott Griffith. To contact our program, you can write me at John, J-O-H-N, at glasshospital.com. That's one word, glasshospital.com. I'm John Schumann. This is Medical Matters. Thanks for listening.